Hi, I'm Brian Mandel, the editor-in-chief of the Cleveland Clinic Journal of Medicine, CCJM. Welcome to Beyond the Pages, CCJM podcast, where we will take you in depth into the content of selected articles from the Cleveland Clinic Journal of Medicine and explore a few interesting tangents along the way. Through moderated interviews with our authors and other experts in the field, we hope the clinicians will gain a more nuanced perspective of clinical concepts that are changing the practice of medicine and be able to apply this perspective to the care of our patients.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Beyond the Pages CCJM podcast. I am Dr. Adam J. Brown, a staff member of Cleveland Clinic's Department of Rheumatic and Immunologic Diseases and board certified in both rheumatology and internal medicine. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Lutfi Abusuan, the director of Cleveland Clinic's Center of Restrictive Thoracic Disorders at the Department of Pulmonary Medicine and associate professor at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University. Welcome, Dr. Abusuan.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little about how you got interested in this field?
Yes, it's interesting. I think my main interest is neuromuscular patients, and I think there's a lot of synergy with sleep. So, for example, sleep studies are essential for neuromuscular patients. There are common pathways. There are common things that intersect between patients with sleep apnea and patients with neuromuscular disorders. So it was a natural fit for me.
All right. And also joining us is Dr. Alan Kaminsky from the Cleveland Clinic's Department of Head and Neck Surgery and is an assistant professor of Cleveland Clinic's Lerner College of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University. Dr. Kaminsky, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right. Can you tell us how you got interested in this field?
Well, I trained as an otolaryngologist and was doing comprehensive otolaryngology, and I was standing in the hallway next to my chairman one day in clinic, and he stepped out of the room and said, "Alan, how would you like to do sleep surgery? I've done a lot of it, and I'm tired." So that's how this whole journey started.
That's how the whole journey, someone was tired, okay? I like it. So speaking of, we're going to be talking about obstructive sleep apnea. And I think people have an idea of this in the world. If they've heard about obstructive sleep apnea, they know it's associated with people who are potentially who are overweight and people who are not so overweight, and people who, you know, transiently stop breathing. I think people kind of have that association with obstructive sleep apnea. But why don't we kind of clear the air here? And why don't we just start with kind of what is obstructive sleep apnea?
Well, in the simplest sense, it's really an obstruction in the upper airway, severe enough to cause either complete cessation of breathing or a partial cessation of breathing with some other disruption, a drop in oxygen, an arousal from sleep, enough to disrupt the quality of the sleep and cause problems that linger in the daytime. So it's a significant disorder, and it's very common. It's often an imbalance between the anatomic features, the tongue, for example, that Dr. Kaminsky deals with, the upper airway structures that tend to collapse, and there's motor pathways that tend to oppose that to keep the airway open. So when there's an imbalance between the two, it results in sleep apnea.
So how is it actually diagnosed?
We diagnose it usually with a sleep study. We don't diagnose this with questionnaires, for example. We don't use prediction tools. We really need a sleep study to diagnose that. It could be in the form of a home sleep apnea test or more extensively a study in the lab.
So why don't you walk me through that? Whenever I try and order a sleep study, I go through this algorithm, and it usually shoots me to ordering a home sleep study. Can you kind of walk me through, like, what is a home sleep study versus, you know, a more intensive sleep study, and how helpful are home sleep studies?
Yeah, so the questionnaires that you go through are designed to guide you to or steer you to order a home sleep apnea test in the individuals where there's a high likelihood of them having sleep apnea. So if this is a patient with a high likelihood and doesn't have comorbidity, so there's no lung disease, there's no neuromuscular problem, there's no heart failure, there's nothing that interferes with the quality of the test, we would go for a home sleep apnea test. Otherwise, our studies are divided in different types, types 1, types 2, type 3, and types 4. Type 1 is the study in the lab, which is an extensive study that includes brain waves, measurements of muscle activity, chin activity, the breathing parameters, the oxygen level. Type 2 is the same, but without monitoring. It's uncommonly done. And type 3 is really what we're talking about in a home sleep apnea test. It requires two channels of breathing, one for effort and one for flow, a cardiac measure, the heart rate, and the oxygen saturation. And that's the one we depend on for a home sleep apnea test. And they tend to be pretty accurate. So for the patients where this questionnaire you go through as you're ordering the test guides you, if it's somebody with a high likelihood of sleep apnea, the test is fairly accurate, 90% accuracy, meaning the true positives and true negatives are pretty high. The problem with the home sleep apnea test is it's maybe underestimating the severity of sleep apnea, so it's most useful to you when it's positive. But a negative test in somebody who has a high likelihood of sleep apnea doesn't exclude sleep apnea. It needs to be pursued.
And can I just jump in? I think it's important to know that even though you may go through the algorithm and it may drive you to a in-lab polysomnogram, the insurance landscape these days make that very, very difficult for many, many patients. So you may have to do a home sleep test first anyway.
So can you kind of walk us through what does this look like for the patient if they're doing it at home? Like, what do you tell them is going to happen?
Well, it's funny because I've had to test different equipment. So I took one of those at home and okay. I've done my own sleep studies, so I know what to expect. It's actually pretty easy. One belt around the belly, one belt around the chest, and there's a positional sensor that tells the system whether you're on your back, on your side. Mm-hmm. There's a catheter that's placed over the nose and a catheter placed over the mouth. The one over the mouth senses the temperature. The one over the nose senses the pressure. So it's a mechanism of safety to make sure if one fails, the other would be working. And we have an oximeter, a little clamp over the finger to measure the oxygen test, and that's it. Press a button, let it run. When you're done, press it off, and that's it. And you return the equipment.
Wow, so you've done this test yourself. As a rheumatologist, I guess I should check my own ANA to see if it's positive. do people ask, oh, is this going to be uncomfortable beforehand? How comfortable was it?
It was very comfortable. The most uncomfortable part, for me at least, was that clamp over my finger, the pulse oximeter. That to me, I remember as being the most uncomfortable, but experience may vary.
Okay.
But I think these tests, it's important to note that unlike an in-lab study, these tests cannot tell whether you're awake or asleep. And so that can make some of the results somewhat...
Very true.
Off kilter, how should I say it?
Yes. So you dilute the number of events over the total hour of recording instead of total hours of sleep, which may make what we call the respiratory event index look lower than what an apnea-hypopnea index would look like on a sleep study.
Okay. So if the home sleep study is negative and the index suspicion is high enough, then you can go to the full study?
Exactly.
But if it's positive, you're done? Or does that also go to the next step?
If it's positive, you don't quite know or you're not fully certain about the severity, but you have a diagnosis. And in the context of somebody who had the sleep study for a reason, an appropriate reason, then you can start treatment.
Okay. So can you give us an idea of how common this is? I mean, people, I think, know about it and talk about it, and people know people who have CPAP machines, for example. But like, what are we looking at? How much is there, I imagine, some variability between countries?
That's a good question. So there's a lot of variance in the prevalence. Let's say about 14% of men and 5% of women, according to large studies, would have sleep apnea severe enough to require or significant enough, clinically significant enough to require treatment. So 14% of men and 5% of women. Worldwide, there's a study showing that there's almost close to 1 billion people on the planet with sleep apnea.
And a billion,
about 938 million people that are suspected of having sleep apnea, at least in the mild or more severe, and maybe half a billion where it's more impactful, more significant, like an apnea hypopnea index that is in the moderate range, not just mild, moderate or severe. So it is quite common.
Yeah.
Actually.
So not too rare, as you mentioned. So, you know, we talked a little bit about how this can be diagnosed. We talked about home sleep studies. We talked about more thorough sleep studies. We talked about a little bit how common this is. So let's talk about what are we going to do about it once the diagnosis is made. And maybe we can start with lifestyle modifications. Like, what do we know about exercise? What do we know about weight loss? What do we know about positional changing? Like, what can you tell a patient to do that may not necessarily be like interventional, like a CPAP or surgery?
Yes, we know that weight loss works. It's just the time frame of response. There are studies showing that if you have aggressive lifestyle modification, that you could result in remission of sleep apnea in a certain percentage of people. Positional changes are helpful as well. And we use those particularly in patients where we feel that there is a positional component. A sleep study will tell us, because even home sleep tests will tell you what the events are on the back compared to the events off the back. So it will tell you that. So these are interventions that do work. Weight loss works because bariatric surgery results in remission in a certain number of patients. Now, depending on the type of surgery, the success is variable. It could be 45% who get remission, 80% who get remission. Roughly, we do expect that 20% of patients undergoing bariatric surgery will not have resolution of their sleep apnea. So we shouldn't have the expectation that bariatric surgery will cure it. I think that needs to be pursued.
Since we're talking about weight loss, I guess that begs the question of, people associate sleep apnea with obesity, but there are some cases where the patient's maybe not obese. I mean, how often does that happen?
Well, that's true. So it's a question of a battle between the anatomic factors, the weight, the neck size, the tongue, and then some anatomic features, which Dr. Kaminsky would be more adept at seeing, like retrognathia or things that are not necessarily related to the to overweight. And there are neurologic factors that, for example, people where the muscle tone particularly is not enough to overcome the obstruction that may occur from anatomic factors.
Yeah, I think it's hearkening back to a previous era when people probably had more obesity hypoventilation syndrome, and that was overlapping with their obstructive sleep apnea, and that became the poster child for somebody with obstructive sleep apnea. But now I think the testing is more sophisticated and more available, and so we pick up more people than we did 40 years ago. And people walk into my office all the time and say, I don't look like somebody who has sleep apnea. And I don't know what somebody with sleep apnea looks like all the time. There are studies out there that suggest that we are terrible at diagnosing somebody with obstructive sleep apnea by physical exam. That's why we need the sleep study.
Right. The features are not very predictive. Looking at the airway is not enough. I would say maybe about 20% of patients with sleep apnea are not obese, not overweight.
20%. Oh, that's higher than I thought. So, okay. So, yeah, I guess that begs the question. So what do you, how is that investigated next in terms of, like, is imaging done, or how do you evaluate the anatomy to try and get a better idea what's causing it?
Well, I think it's important to know that the first line of treatment, which is CPAP, it doesn't matter what the cause is. You try and treat it and see if it gets better. And if it gets better on CPAP, it probably doesn't matter what the anatomical cause is. The only time when it comes into question is when CPAP is not successful, then what do you do? And I think that's when the physical exam does come into play. But even then, sitting in my office, I can see if somebody is retrognathic, if they have macroglossia, if they have huge tonsils, grade 3 or grade 4 tonsils, which are obstructing the airway. But that's not the majority of the patients who I see. And then it's much, much more difficult. You know, we may even have to go to the operating room and do a sedated endoscopy to take a look at the airway, take a look at the palate, the oropharynx, hypopharynx, base of tongue, epiglottis, and see if we can identify an area of collapse or narrowing.
This concludes part one of this episode. Please join us for part two as our conversation continues beyond the pages.
Thank you for your insights in helping us to go beyond the pages of the Cleveland Clinic Journal of Medicine. To read CCJM articles, visit ccjm.org. To participate in other accredited educational activities, visit ccfcme.org. You can subscribe to the podcast on Google Play, Spotify, or however you prefer to access your podcasts.